Now, our reading tonight is from the Book of Psalms, and we give consideration after some introductory remarks to one particular psalm, number 92. Psalm number 92. Psalm 92, a psalm or song for the Sabbath day. It is a good thing to give thanks unto the Lord and to sing praises unto thy name, O Most High. To show forth thy loving kindness in the morning and thy faithfulness every night upon an instrument of 10 strings and upon the psaltery, upon the harp with a solemn sound. For thy Lord hath made me glad through thy work. I will triumph in the works of thy hands. O Lord, how great are thy works, and thy thoughts are very deep. A brutish man knoweth not, neither doth a fool understand this. When the wicked spring as the grass, and when all the workers of iniquity do flourish, it is that they shall be destroyed forever. But thou, Lord, art most high for evermore. For lo thine enemies, O Lord, for lo thine enemies shall perish. All the workers of iniquity shall be scattered, but my horn shall thou exalt like the horn of a unicorn. I shall be anointed with fresh oil. Mine eye also shall see my desire on mine enemies, and mine ears shall hear my desire of the wicked that rise up against me. The righteous shall flourish like the palm tree. He shall grow like a cedar in Lebanon. Those that be planted in the house of the Lord shall flourish in the courts of our God. They shall still bring forth fruit in old age. They shall be fat and flourishing to show that the Lord is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. Now that's a brief reading that we have had, and we trust with the Lord's good blessing. Hopefully we'll be able to make our comments upon this beautiful psalm brief. Fairly brief as well. Now, I can see looking across the audience that we have quite a few who are with us for the first time. We are glad to see you. I know you couldn't be here before. So, while it will be totally impossible to go over the ground that we have already covered, and I have no desire to do that, I will try and make some general comments and then come to this particular psalm that will both be an introduction for those who are here for the first time, and will be a reminder and a refresher for those who have already been here. As you all know, the subject before us in these nights is a consideration of the practical lessons that are relevant for us today, lessons which are embedded in the institution of the ancient Jewish Sabbath. We have been amazed, or at least are beginning to be amazed, at the tremendous quantity of biblical material that pertains to that specific subject. Indeed, there is so much material that it is amazing that we hear so little about the particular subject. Maybe because some have abused the subject, that in turn has meant that others avoid it. And of course, by avoiding it, we are really missing out. Because something's abused, it doesn't mean you abandon it. I could use a knife to cut your throat. But because I can abuse a knife that way, it doesn't mean that I stop using knives. Knives properly used can be very, very advantageous. So it is with the doctrines of the Bible. Abused, they can be very hurtful. Employed properly, they can be very helpful. Now, to try and put the subject into some, I suppose they're rather arbitrary, but at least they're manageable little compartments, we are following the path that I mentioned just now. On Sunday evening here, in the Gospel meeting, we thought about the preacher's Sabbath. And we went with the great apostle into the synagogue at Pisidia in Antioch. And we listened to him as he offered to the people that were gathered on that occasion the blessing of the sure mercy of David. What a Sabbath preaching that was, the preacher's Sabbath in Acts 13. We spent a good little part of the time on Monday evening, thinking about the primary Sabbath, the Sabbath that we read about as the seventh day at the beginning of Genesis chapter 2, when God had completed creation. I'll be back to that just in a minute. Then we talked last night about the prescribed Sabbath, where God gave Israel some very detailed instructions. I'll say a little bit more about that again, just to reinforce it in our mind. God prescribed Sabbath day observance, seventh day observance, in our language, Saturday observance, for the nation of Israel. Tomorrow night, I want to think about the Pharisaical Sabbath, because we'll be moving. The reason I'm gathering together a number of things tonight is because we'll be leaving this aspect. We'll be moving tomorrow night into New Testament material, and we will see that the Pharisees, they made quite a mess of what God had instituted. And that's what often happens to divine institutions. In the hands of men, they become depraved and distorted. And then we conclude, all being well on Friday night, with a look at the prophetic Sabbath. And tonight, we have only one poem in all of the Bible written to celebrate the Sabbath day. In fact, out of the book of Psalms, out of the 150 Psalms, this is the only Psalm that is dedicated to the celebration of a day. It's very unique. So we're going to look at the poetic Sabbath as it is celebrated in this very, very precious Psalm. Now, having said that, broadly speaking again, we have been, up until this point, we have been thinking of the Sabbath in connection with three people or in connection with three parties. First of all, we have thought about the Sabbath in relation to God. And then we have thought about the Sabbath in relation to the nation. And then we have thought about the Sabbath in relation to believers. Now, each one of those Sabbaths is to be distinguished, and each one is slightly different. As far as God is concerned, it's the Sabbath of the Creator. As far as the Jew is concerned, it's the Sabbath of the children of Israel. And as far as we are concerned, of course, it is the Sabbath of the Christian. Now, each one of those Sabbaths, the Creator's Sabbath, the children of Israel's Sabbath, and the Christian Sabbath, each one must be distinguished, or it will just become, as I said last night, a total mess and muddle. Now, as far as the Creator is concerned, and I'm repeating this intentionally, his was a special Sabbath. We did emphasize on Monday evening those references, three references to the seventh day, and I'll be back. That will be a key passage. I'll have to go back to that, especially on Friday evening. But we emphasized it also on Monday evening, that when God had finished it all, he rested. And then I didn't elaborate upon it last night, but there is a reference in the book of Exodus chapter 31, an additional verse. It not only says that God rested, it says he was refreshed. I love that. Now, God's rest, it wasn't the rest of weariness or fatigue. It was the rest and refreshment of total satisfaction in what he had produced. He surveyed the works, the creatorial works of the 6 days. Not a flaw to the scene. And in the joy of what he himself had made, he rested and was refreshed. That's a special Sabbath that belongs to God as Creator in a special, singular, unique sense. You know, sometimes we say, and it's not strictly correct, but I know what we mean, and I'm not splitting hairs or finding fault. We say that the climax of creation was the 6 day. God did this on day 1 and day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5. For on the 6 day, he made man in his own image. And we say that Adam was the crown, was the jewel in the crown of creation. And on the 6 day, with the creation of man in his image and likeness, creation had reached its climax. Now that is not correct. The creation of man is not the climax of creation. The climax of creation is the rest of God. Man is not the goal. We are living in a world where man has become the center of everything, and everything has to contribute to our credit, and to our comfort, and to our advancement. God is the only creature in the universe who is ceaselessly
endlessly striving for his own glory. We are not the goal. God himself is the goal. And the first day, the first full day that man ever knew in time was a Sabbath day. Because Adam was created at some point on the sixth day, and then Eve was taken from his side later, and then the next day, of course, was this seventh day, where man enjoyed rest to some measure with the God who had produced creation. If I aim for my own glory, that's sin. That's selfishness. If you aim for your glory, that's the same. God can aim for his glory, and that's sovereignty. And that's what he's always aiming for. We need to keep that constantly in mind. The Creator Sabbath, it was fine. Then, as far as the children of Israel are concerned, I'm moving now to the second group. What will I say about their Sabbath? Their Sabbath was specified. It wasn't optional, it was obligatory. It wasn't something they could choose to do. It was something that was commanded. Now, I emphasized at great length last night, and I don't want to go over it, but it does need to be emphasized because there's such a false idea floating around by folks who call themselves Seventh-day Adventists and other folks as well. We need to constantly reiterate and remember, especially the younger Christians, that no other nation under heaven, given amongst men, at any time or at any place in history, no other nation was ever commanded to keep the Sabbath day except the children of Israel. It was a hallmark of their holiness. It was specially given to them so that if God not only ever demanded that other Gentiles keep the Sabbath, you can be absolutely sure that he doesn't mandate that Christians keep it. There was only one nation, and it was specified. Now why? This is coming again. We mentioned some exceedingly practical things last night, and I touched one or two of them very, very quickly and one or two others. First of all, God specified the Sabbath for the children of Israel because he wanted them to be marked out as a different people. Different. No other nation, no other tribe ever kept this day. And as the children of Israel kept this day, they demonstrated that in their timetable, in their calendar, in the way that they used the days of the week, they demonstrated that because we are related to God and because we obey God, the way in which we use time is different to everybody else on the face of the earth. You know, God expects us to use our time differently. Men of the world use our time to squander. I'm not going over a whole list of things now, brethren and sisters, but I would say this, that what the world calls leisure time is one of the biggest tests of a person's character. How you use your discretionary time. The man of the world spends his time at sports events. The man of the world spends his time in the lounge bar. The man of the world spends his time sitting in front of the silver screen. But you and I, because we are people who have caught a breath of eternity, and we relate our time to the God who has saved us, we would never be found squandering our time on such idle pursuits. One of the things that marks a Christian as distinct is the way in which he uses time. God said, I'm specifying that you people keep the Sabbath day different from all the other nations because I want you to be a distinct people. Secondly, he says, I want you to be a delivered people. So he said, that's why I have given you one day off. He said, I mentioned this on Monday night in passing in connection with the manna. He said, old Pharaoh wouldn't give you a day off. He said, the other nations all around you, they work 7 days a week. But he said, I don't want you to become slaves to your work. And he says, not only take it off yourself, but he says, release the animals and release the slaves. He said, don't you be taking the day off and make your slave still be engaged in work. He said, give him some freedom as well. For he said, I have made you a free people. And he said, I want you to see not only people, your manservant and your maidservant, your son and your daughter. He said, I not only want you to see people with dignity. He said, I want you to see animals with dignity. For he said, you're a free people. You see, one of the features of the world in which we live, now I said already, I'm not going back on this, we are not mandated, no one is mandated to keep the Sabbath day. But I still believe that in that ancient institution, while we do not keep the Sabbath day, God has established certain guidelines and principles. And the world has abandoned them. And they want to have production going 7 days a week. What has been the result of this mass production never ceasing 7 days a week? You see, God said no breakfast. He said, I regard you as personality. He said, if you're going to work 7 days a week, he said, the 7 days of labor will become perfunctory. And he said, you will become mechanical. And he said, you'll wither and you'll shrink in your soul and in your person. He said, I want to give you people a day where you can become refreshed emotionally, spiritually, physically, ethically, and every way. He said, for I want you to be people that are your very best. It's good to think that God is concerned about people domestically, socially, agriculturally, materially, personally, physically. God was concerned about the whole arena. Now, as I was going to say there before I was slightly sidetracked, one of the end results of the world in which we live, where they want 7 day labor and never ceasing and never stopping. You know what has happened? Men are just treated like machines. And you go to many workplaces. Now you just stay with me tonight. We'll leave theology for a minute. Although there's nothing more theology in this than you think. You go to many workplaces where the ingenuity of man has produced machines. And where people are compelled to stand for 12-hour shifts, 7 days a week, or 7 nights a week, even worse, 7 nights a week before a machine. You meet a man coming off from that production, man. You know what he's like? He's like a zombie. He's just wrecked. He's drained. He's fatigued. His personality is just standing, pressing buttons or doing something, and he never gets a break, and his personality, it just becomes drunk by the pleasure. Now God said, I don't want to produce a nation of zombies and machines. He says, I want a nation of personality. People who will be rounded. People who will be whole. People who will not be split and shriveled. He said, I want you to be not only a distinct people, but I want you to be a delivered people. One of the problems, now just let me say a little bit about work, the work ethic of a Christian. One of the problems of our modern age is this, that with electricity and lights and so on, we can extend working hours indefinitely. I just listened to a little bit of reasoning here, practical reasoning, very, very quickly, and I very, very quickly. You see, go back to, say, the 1500s. The man had to quit work when it became dark. He had to go home. And he couldn't watch a video. He couldn't even read a book for very long. He might have had a little, some sort of a lamp or a candle, but he had to go to bed early. He got well slept, well rested. He got up early. He got up for the fresh part of the morning. The cycle of his life was very, very much attuned to the cycle which had been made by the Creator. Then along marched the Industrial Revolution. Machinery and mechanics and all these things were made. Electricity came. Now we can burn the light. So we can come home at night and we can work to 12 o'clock if need be. Put the machine on and the machine can work all night. Out of tune with the Creator. But nevertheless,
We will see that all. We will see that all. Mark me now.
The man leaves his work. Nowadays, of course, they can put down a great deal of work down the telephone line via email. Once he gets home, he can download into his computer as much work as keeps him going to 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, or all night if he wishes. Now, one thing that you need to watch, some of you brethren that are very keen on overtime, and you need money to finance all the additional expenses that you're gathering around you and to sustain your modern lifestyle. One of the things that you need to watch is this. By means of modern devices, inventions, and I'm not looking to go back to the Dark Ages or the Middle Ages, not at all. I'm not complaining about them. We appreciate much that technology has introduced. By means of these modern inventions, there's one thing that you can do, and there's another thing you can't do. And these two things are at loggerheads. And the Christian has to get a balance between the two of them, or else the possibility is he'll make spiritual shipwreck. If he doesn't make spiritual shipwreck, he could make matrimonial shipwreck. Because too much work at the mechanics and the material and the money and not enough work to get married. If he doesn't make spiritual shipwreck or matrimonial shipwreck, he could make emotional or nervous shipwreck, or he could make physical shipwreck. Now the two things are this. By means of these inventions, we can greatly lengthen the working day. Instead of working from 9 to 5, you can work from 9 to 10. The light, the computer, and so on, to keep it all going. We can greatly lengthen the working day. But remember, there's one thing we can't. And this is the bugbear of the whole business. While you can lengthen the working day, you can't lengthen the day. If I could lengthen my working day from 7 hours to 12 hours, that would be okay if I could also lengthen the day from 24 hours to 29 hours. I can lengthen my working day, but I can't lengthen the day. So that if I lengthen my working day, I'm eating out of the day. So if the working day is mine, but the day is God's, I can lengthen my working week. So can you.
But remember the thing that you can never do, you can never lengthen the week. And all this talk to people, I'll need another day in the week. And I'll need so many extra hours in the day. That is just all symptomatic of a secular world that is pressurizing us and squeezing us like the segment of a dried oil. Until there's hardly anything left. And we have to take the discipline into our hands. And we have to get back to appreciate the Sabbath. Now I've ended up going over quite a bit of practical stuff there, but dear brethren, watch that now, because that's a vital thing, brethren and sisters, especially those of you who are in careers. And like, I'm not talking about laziness. I would maybe work a few hours every day myself. You'll find it difficult to believe, but it is true. And maybe I would go working when some of you folks will be sleeping. So I'm not just saying to stop everything at 5, but I am saying to watch these principles, because God didn't want them to become slaves to their work after he had delivered them from the slavery of Egypt. A distinct people, a deliberate people, a devoted people. Because why did he give them a day off? Well, you say give them a day off, they put it in the sea. Say, well, if you don't have a swim in the Red Sea. That's all. Well, you see, they were to go to have a barbecue in the backyard, and they were to sit down a lazy boy chair, whatever you call those swinging things, and they were to lean back and lie up. Not at all.
God did not mandate that the Sabbath should have no activity. God mandated that the Sabbath day would be a change of activity. So what they previously dedicated to earth, to material things, to secular things, to domestic things,
they would now dedicate to him,
so that they would now use this time for him. And it would be a day of celebration. It would be a day of holy consecration. It would be a day of convocation. It would be a day of communion with himself.
I used to hear Mr. McShane say, I don't know, this must be going back into holy antiquity. You'll know that when you hear it, because none of us live like this today. I think now, this is only a thought. I think it was Mr. Dyke that he was quoting. And in those grand old days of antiquity, when people were a little wiser than we are, there are 2 days' holidays a year. Wasn't the badness in the country as there is? Wasn't the violence and the vice? You see, work's good for a man. God instituted labor as a preservative in a fallen world. Anyway, Mr. Dyke said he was really glad to get 2 days of his work, because it gave him a lot more time for prayer. I know when you say we get 2 days off your work, well, it's so much praying you do. And I'm the same. We get 2 days off of work, it gives us a lot more time to play. That man got 2 days off his work, it gave him more time to pray.
You ask yourself, who had the best? Who had the best time management? That godly gentleman, whenever it was, I suppose it was the tail end of the 19th century or the early 20th century, or is it ourselves who have become caught in the whirlpool of worldliness and we're becoming sucked in to the vortex
of just materialism and a pleasure-loving society, and into that vortex we're being drawn down to ground level. Instead of maintaining the Sabbath principle like these days, when we would rise from earth and reach up to God. A devoted people, a disciplined people, a different people, and a dedicated people, and a dependent people. Because, as I mentioned last night, they might say to themselves, if we take the seventh day off, it's a whole day. A whole day. What about, Lord? What about having a Sabbath service on Friday evening? And we'll do out any work until lunchtime, so sorry. But a whole day? A whole day? If we have to give you a whole day, that means like over 15%. They were to give more of their time than they were of their time. Time's a big thing with God. The God who made time made enough of it for every one of us. And he is a prayer claim upon us. May God help us to think about that. But he said, if we take that day, we're going to lose out. Well, of course they didn't lose out, for God looked after them. And he even made them give the land a rest every 7 years for a whole year. And the Bible tells us that the next year he multiplied their crops. See, they tell the old story. They tell the old story about a caravan that was going right across America many, many moons ago. And they reached the point, they were heading for Oregon. And they reached the point where they said to themselves, now we'll never make it before the hard winter comes. And if the winter comes before we get there, we're finished. They were, at that stage, they were traveling 6 days and taking 1 day off completely. That was the rhythm they followed. I'm not sure whether it was for any biblical reason or not, but that was their rhythm. They had a dispute. They said, now look, if we are going to make it to Oregon, we before the winter, we better go 7 days. This business of taking 1 day off will never work. They still have something like 1,500 miles to go. So they had quite a dispute about it, and they decided we'll split into two. Half of us will go 7 days a week. The other half says, we just keep going the way we were going. 6 days traveling, 1 day rest. And I'll give you 20 pence piece if you can guess who got the Oregon course. The boys that traveled 7 days, they were miles shorter than the ones that traveled 6 days and took 1 day off. If we give God our time, I spoke to our brother and speaking out about the Lord's Day. This brother didn't believe the Lord's Day was a Sabbath, but he believed that he should give God part of his time. This is this year, earlier this year, in another country. I'll not mention any more details. I happened to be asked him what he worked at, and I knew one or two other details about the thing. So he told me. He said, David, 17 years ago, my son and myself, he said, we started a little business here in the city.
Mm-hmm.
It went very well. He said, within 3 years, that we were the first, we're pioneers in this little thing. It grew nicely, but he said, within 3 years, there were 12 others going as well. Quite a bit of competition, but he says it was friendly competition. We used to meet together for a coffee and talk about things, and we all, there was a part for each one of us, and we were doing comfortably and nicely. He said in one of our discussions, the other 12, maybe 12 of them all together, I think it was, he said, the other 11 said, look, we've decided we're going to do Sunday opening. All the other places were doing it. So he said, I was really unhappy. He said, I knew my commitment to the assembly. I wanted to give a day to God, free from every thought of business and so on. And he said, it brought me to a crisis. Now I'm not saying you follow this, but just listen to the story. It's true. He said, I came back. We needed time to think about it. We came back 2 weeks later. And he said, I had thought about it. And I said, no, gentlemen, I'm not going to. They were like, yeah. So he said, well, too bad. We're going to go anyway. So they all opened on Sunday. That's 12 years ago. How many of those businesses are open today? Just one. Just one. And the one business that is still going well is a brother that wouldn't open on the Lord's Day. The other 11 closed. Now that's not a story from the 18th century. That's a story from the 1990s and the 2004. And all I'm saying is, may God help us to give honor him with our time and with our talents. Because the Sabbath principle, the Creator had a special Sabbath. The children of Israel had a commanded Sabbath. What about the Christian Sabbath? What is our Sabbath? I just mentioned this and then a better comment. Our Sabbath is not a date. It's not a day. It's not a specified Sabbath. Our Sabbath is a spiritual Sabbath. Because we enjoy rest. We enjoy rest 7 days a week. And thank God we'll enjoy rest for all eternity. Just as. And this is the principle of it all. Just as in creation, God worked for 6 days. And he produced rest on the seventh day, into which Adam was introduced. In redemption, God the Son has labored. He didn't labor for 6 days. He did a work in 6 hours on which eternity hides. And as a result of that 6 hour labor of our blessed Lord and Savior, many of us in this meeting tonight have entered into rest. We've often looked upon the work of that 6 hours, and we sing very gratefully the times on the Lord's Day morning. Here we rest. In wonder beauty, all our sins on Jesus laid, and a full redemption flowing from the sacrifice he made. It was a toil. It was a mighty work. I like the words of Edward Denny. Again, we sing them from time to time on the same occasion. The storm that bowed his blessed head are hushed forever now, and rest divine is ours instead, while glory crowns his blood. The children of Israel had a Sabbath. I tell you, brothers and sisters, it was a specified Sabbath. We have a spiritual Sabbath that transcends theirs by far. Theirs was a 24-hour Sabbath. Ours is an everlasting Sabbath that will never see an evening, because what we have in Christ can never be. Time and death, it can never be. Now, this psalm that we have read tonight, you say, I began to wonder, why did you bother reading it? Oh, well, I'll tell you now. The psalm
is perhaps about the only part of the Old Testament which definitely gives us an insight into the kind of worship that the Israelites offered on the Sabbath day. Because I take it this song, it's called a song. You know, God didn't intend that Sabbath day to be a drive. He intended it to be a delight. He didn't intend it to be a burden. He intended it to be a blessing. And hence, we have a song composed for the Sabbath day. I might say generally, just before we come into the three parts of this Psalm, that it's only people who enjoy Sabbath rest, both spiritually and in principle, it's only those who enjoy times of communion with God that will be able to compose songs like this. Mind you, again, I'm not going back to some of those days. We live in our own generation. We can't turn the clock back. But some of the sweetest hymns that we sing, they were composed by men and women. And they deliberately chose a lifestyle. Some of them were very wealthy, mind you. Some of them had quite big positions in administration and in worldly things. But they deliberately curtailed their lifestyle so that they had quiet times with God. And out of the Sabbath of their soul, and out of the rest of their soul, and out of the depth of time-honored communion, they wrote some of those lovely hymns that we sing so freely on the Lord's Day morning. And you wonder, what is it produces such composition? Well, as I said already, brothers and sisters, it's communion with God that produces poetry like that. It did appear. Now, in this particular psalm, the three parts of it, all I say, and I'll try and get through them, I'll not touch every detail, but I'll try and mention this. In the first four verses, we discover that those who enjoy Sabbath communion with God, they'll discover it to be something that generates praise. Because the psalm says it is good to give thanks, and I speak about praise. In the next verses, from verses 5 down to verse number 11, he thinks about the destruction of the wicked. We'll discover in that section that Sabbath communion not only generates praise, but it gives perspective. And then in the closing verses, from verse 12 down to verse 15, the righteous shall flourish like a palm tree, they'll be like a cedar, bring forth fruit, they'll be fat and flourishing. It not only generates praise and grants perspective, but it guarantees progress. Wherever people enjoy Sabbath in their souls, they will make progress and headway in the things of God. Now, I'm pausing again, and I know you think that I'm overdoing it, maybe I am. And I'm a sharer with all you dear believers in this. I believe that the pace of life in our day, and it's hard to detach yourself from, and the claims upon our time, and the invasions into our lives, I believe that if we allow those things to overtake our lives, we will be robbing ourselves of the very things that I have just mentioned. We lose our praise. We lose our perspective. And we certainly lose out in our progress that I have mentioned in the final part of the staff. Now, just this first matter, the first four verses. It is good. A good thing. To give thanks unto the Lord and to sing praises unto thy name, O Most High. Now, I'll mention just a few things. It's good. It's a good thing to give thanks. Did you hear that? Every one of you, dear brother, who are my friends in Christ, did you hear that? It's a good thing to give thanks. I'm thinking I'm thinking about 11:30. Victoria Street. Victoria Street Hall. Barn Bridge. County Down. 11:30. On Lord's Day morning. To all the dear brethren here, and the sisters, but I'm thinking of public Thanksgiving. Dear brethren, it's a good thing. I'm not now speaking about Barn Bridge, but you know that just with the curriculum of our lives, we're traveling around from place to place. And I'm beginning to come to the conclusion that there must be some verse in the Bible say it's a bad thing to give thanks. Because there are so many brethren slow to do it. There are so many silences. There are so many glaring gaps in a remembrance meeting. But why? You see, if you're going to be able to give thanks, you need to have the Sabbath in your soul. You can't rush from post to pillar. And you can't move from paper to magazine. And you can't switch from program to program. And you can't visit from house to house on Saturday night. And when you climb the steps out there, switch it off on Sunday morning. There has to be the Sabbath of soul rest in the presence of God. And then it'll be a glad thing. And it'll be a good thing to give thanks. Mind you, if there is free Thanksgiving in the meeting, and I take it this is congregational in Psalm 92, but you know, I wonder at times, is one of the reasons why we're not good at giving thanks on the occasion that I just mentioned, maybe we don't give thanks enough privately. We pray, and we ask God, you know, we're soon going to be finished praying. And we're soon going to be finished preaching. But thanksgiving is going to be our everlasting occupation. And let me say with the Sabbath psalm, it's a good thing. Now, in fact, if I turned over here in the book of Psalms, I could find other adjectives. And you find them, and you put them all together. In fact, for younger believers, it'll be a very wholesome, interesting little study. And you've all got your concordances and computer Bibles, or whatever they call them. And they're a disadvantage in many cases, but I'm not going to that just now. Go through the Bible and pick out the things that are described as being good. It is good. Write them down. Meditate upon them. What I'm going to mention now are some of the things that are said about praise. You know, over here a little bit we read that praise is comely. Praise is good. And praising, thanking God is pleasant. It's good. It's comely. It's pleasant. It's pleasant because it's something beautiful. It's good because it's something beneficial. And it's comely because it's something befitting. You know, it befits us and it befits God. He has done so much for us. I don't want to split hairs, but just when I'm on this particular topic, and don't let this hamper you in any way, there's a difference between praising God, worshipping God, and thanking God. That in a sense, we can engage in all three in any one time of prayer. But there's a slight difference. When I'm thanking God, I'm recognizing what He has given. When I'm praising God, I'm recognizing what He has done. When I'm worshiping God, I'm recognizing what He is. What He has given, what He has done, and what He is. And the Bible says it's good. Good for what? Well, first of all, it's good for God. Because He loves us. He loves us. Did you hear about the great robbery yesterday?
I listened to the news today at 1 o'clock and I noticed they didn't mention it. I bought the Times newspaper and they never mentioned it either. You hear the big robbery yesterday? Millions! Millions in gold! And there wasn't one of the media mentioned. Someone said that we live on the silent planet. You know, there were millions of people yesterday spent their day and breathed the fresh air which God gave and ate the food and took the sleep that God granted to them. And from their hearts they never rose a single note of praise. God is the God who is robbed by the world of ungrateful humanity, and the great robbery took place today. And I would have to acknowledge that as far as I was concerned today, I was guilty of a little bit of it as well. But I hope that speaking generally, God not wrath with us. That we acknowledge his gift and we glory. It's good. It's good for him. And let me tell you, dear brother and sister, if you come with Sabbath conditions in your soul and you really enter into joyful gratitude before God and holy jubilation and really get into the thing and really thank him, I can tell you it'll be good for you. And let me tell you, dear brethren, something else. Because some of you think that you have to give a whole speech and that you just don't have the language to do it and you haven't the nerve to get up. Don't worry too much about that. Because big spiels don't go that far. You see, if you get up and with a few simple sentences, it comes from the depth of your heart. It'll be good for God. I can guarantee you, it'll maybe break the sweat on your brow, and it'll make your knees knock, and you'll sit down like a 100-weight sack, and you'll wonder, what have I done? But you see, after a little while, it'll be good for you. And I want to tell you thirdly, it'll be good for others. Because other people will be enriched and edified by your honest, heartfelt contribution. He says, it is good. Oh, this is a man in the good of Sabbath communion with a Sabbath outlook. He says it will be a tonic. The tonic of his praise. It is good. I was going to speak about the titles of his praise. He says, I'll praise thy name, Lord. You'll find Lord 7 times in this psalm. I think that's another reason why it's a Sabbath psalm. It focuses on the Lord. And he calls God the Most High. And then I was going to speak about the themes of his praise. He said in verse number 2, thy loving kindness in the morning and thy faithfulness every night. I was going to speak about the times of his praise. Oh, he said, I'll do it in the morning and I'll do it at night. The tonic of it, the titles of it, the themes of it, the times of it. I tell you, we have plenty to praise of it. Whether it's the bright experiences of life's morning, whether it's the shadowy experiences of night's evening, he says that things are bright. He says, I praise thee for thy loving kindness. And he said, when things are getting dark, he said, I praise thee for thy faithfulness. You see, here's a man, and he's in the good of communion with his soul, and he can see that every single situation in life, it is an opportunity for praising God. This is what it means to live a Sabbath life. Then he speaks about the tunes of his praise. He says, I'm going to do it with an instrument of 10 strings. I know some fellas, they do the instrument of 1 string. 1 string. And you nearly know the tempo that it'll be every day. You know, but he says, I'm going to do it. He says, I take it that an instrument of 10 strings was the biggest one you could get. He says, I have so many chords to strike, and I have so many choruses to sing to this Lord, the God of creation, and the God who has redeemed me and blessed me, and my soul is so filled with Sabbath delight, and I'm rested in him. He said, I need to get the biggest instrument available, 10 strings. What about What about some of you brethren that haven't pulled a string for many a day? It concerns me about some who never did it, but I'm also concerned about some who used to do it and have stopped doing it. And many of them it's because they're so busy in their lives and have so many commitments that it's been dried up. What strings will you use? Well, I'm going to give you 10 strings. Use these 10 faculties. 2 ears. 2 eyes. 2 hands. 2 feet. 2 lips. What you read, what you hear, what you handle, where you go, and what you speak, let every one of them vibrate with the praise of the great Sabbath God of creation. He said, my praise will touch my whole being. And he said, I will be in tune with heaven. I was going to speak about the thrill of his praise, because he tells us in verse number 4, thou hast made me glad through thy work. He says, I'm absolutely thrilled. I'm thrilled. Oh, he says, it really gets me excited. And he says, it gets me, it uplifts me. And he says, it carries me heavenward and Godward. And he said, it really gladdens me. And, you know, I'll be honest, there's nothing, well, maybe I shouldn't say nothing, because that might be a little exaggeration. But there's one thing that, oh, I hate to see a fellow starting at the Lord's table slouch. And he holds a hymnbook in his hand like that. And a hand he's tall. And a cow looking over the gate with more intelligence in his eyes. And he has as much interest in what's going on as the crows have. And there's no joy. And there's no rapture. And there's no enthusiasm. And it doesn't catch him. Oh, he says, this man says, he says, I have meditated on this Sabbath subject so much, he says, thou hast made me glad through thy work. I can't understand people that gather together on such holy occasions and tell me this, people, will we ever hear about a greater work than the work of Christ? If it doesn't gladden us, I can't think of anything else. I was going to speak about the triumph of his praise, because he says, I will triumph in the work of thy hands. It gave him a sense of victory. It gave him a sense of holy, heavenly joy. It carried him into another world. I tell you, all this is something that flows out of a Sabbath enjoyment. Now I leave the middle part. But it's important. Because he says, now I'm in a world where wickedness seems to triumph. But he says, I just rest my case with the Lord. For he said, I can see that the day is coming when the wicked shall perish. He said, they seem to flourish. They seem to prosper. But he said, the wicked soon will perish. They'll be scattered and there'll be no more. And he said, all the enemies of the Lord will be completely dispelled. And when the psalmist goes into God's presence, he gets perspective. You know, some of you Christians, you might be the victim of cheating. You might be the victim of lies at your work. You might be the victim of discrimination just because you're a Christian. Mind you, the world in which we live hasn't changed from the world of the psalmist. The wicked still prosper. And if that just gets to you, it gets you down. When wicked seems to get the upper hand, and you're being crushed beneath the sole of the boot of the unrighteous and the unprincipled, the brutish, he calls them the brutish, and the foolish, they just go about like animals. And they have no regard for God, and they tramp everywhere, and they press everyone down. The psalmist says, now that's what I have. But he says, my only answer to that state of affairs is to get into God's presence and get my perspective renewed. He said, the prosperity of the wicked will be short-lived. But he says, the righteous, they will flourish for them. Now I conclude just with a little bit on the third part of the psalm. You see, Sabbath communion, it generates praise. Sabbath communion gives perspective. Those communion, that's Psalm 73 again. And now at the end of the psalm, from verses 12 to verse number 15, Sabbath communion, it guarantees progress. If you have your Bible open, you will notice very quickly the repetition of the little word flourish. You know, he says in verse 12,
The righteous shall flourish.
That's a lovely verb. Shall flourish like the palm tree, like the cedar.
Verse 13. Those that be planted in the house of God shall flourish. Verse 14. They shall still bring forth fruit in old age. They shall be fat on flourishing.
You know, it's great to flourish, isn't it? We would love to do better. We would love to have more blossoms and to have more fruit in our lives. May God grant that we'll enjoy more of Sabbath communion because it guarantees growth and progress.
Verse number 11 tells us how they'll flourish.
So like a palm tree or a cedar.
You know, the palm has been called the princess of the world of vegetation.
And as you know very well, the cedar has been designated the king of trees.
Wherever people enjoy communion with God, it brings a dignity to their lives. The stateliness of a palm, I would love to talk about the palm tree.
You know, the palm tree doesn't carry much down here, but it has a great...
The most of the palm trees up at the top.
Many of us have branches so much filling the ground. You know, that's not like most trees. Most trees are bigger here, and then they taper in. You know that. Not a palm tree. A palm tree smaller here, and the higher you go, the wider things become. I would love to live like that.
We're down to earth. There's very little riches. And the higher you would go in my thinking, and the higher you would go in my mind, and the closer to heaven,
the wider things would become. That's like a palm tree.
Absolutely straight. With his very stiff bark. You know, actually, an interesting thing just in connection with that about a palm tree is, a palm tree, most trees, the older they get,
like most humans,
the older they get, there's a noticeable increase in girth.
I've noticed that with most of you folks, that I'm greatly encouraged to have been delivered myself.
But as it increases in height, it also increases in width. And the trunk gets bigger and bigger. You see, a palm tree, if you get a palm tree that's 80 years old, and some of them can live to 200 and still be very fruit. If you get a 100-year-old palm tree, and you get a 20-year-old palm tree,
the two of them will have the same thickness. But the 100-year-old one will be much taller.
So that as a palm tree gets on, it doesn't spread any wider in this world, but it reaches up.
I'd like to be like that.
So that as I live on in this world, I'm not spreading any more across it as far as taking up space on this old beleaguered earth is concerned.
But we might be reaching up to the stateliness of a palm and the stability of a cedar. Somebody was speaking to me just at the dinner table there about the greatness of the cedar. They saw cedars in the Mediterranean, in one of the islands of the Mediterranean, and they were really impressed with them. I tell you, that's nice, but you want to see a cedar of Lebanon in Lebanon. He says, well, not just like the cedars off Lebanon. He says it'll be like a cedar in Lebanon.
Well, rooted, rising up, reaching for the snow-clad peaks
of those clearer climes.
That's what it's like to flourish. If we enjoy communion, it will, that's how we'll flourish, like a palm and like a cedar. Finally, the next verse tells us where we'll flourish.
He says we'll flourish in the house of the Lord.
Those that are planted. He said they'll be well rooted. They'll have a place where they'll look to be.
You know, can I say to young believers, and it's good to see some such at the meetings on various nights, we would love that you would flourish for God. And there's one thing I'll say to you with all my heart is that if you really want to grow
and to have grace and glory and spiritual grandeur in your life,
my advice to you is this. Get well rooted in the assembly.
Planted in the courts of the Lord and in the house of our God. Put your roots, don't be waiting about. Don't be going about from one fellowship to another.
No, that's a very vexatious thing for rising believers, young believers,
you are bombarded by the offer of so many groups and seminars and meetings that are not assembly-based. Some of them are giving, I'm quite sure, very interesting Bible teaching. But you see, we're not just interested in Bible teaching. We are interested in testimony. Now, testimony needs Bible teaching. But a Bible teaching is going to flourish and produce an orchard for the glory of God. It will have to be rooted. It will have to be rooted and planted in the courts of God's house, in the confines of the assembly. How they go is like a palm and a cedar. Where they go is in the courts of the Lord. And when they go, when they grow, he says they'll flourish even into old age. They'll go on, it'll not stop. You know, cedars can go for 200 years. 2,000 years, I beg your pardon. Palms can go for 200 years. Cedars can go for 2,000, and they can still be producing. May God help us. You older believers, you know there are older brethren and sisters that I have known around Barnbridge. Some of you looked ancient when I came here as a boy in 1970, and you're still knocking around. You just look about as ancient now as you did then, or then as you do now. And you're still keen. And you're still here. Some might show signs of wear physically, but they still have a freshness spiritually. It's great to have you. You know, you look at some of those old cedars up in Lebanon, and you say, boy, you see that big one there? He is weathered many a straw. You say he was there standing away back in 1940, and he's still there. More dignity and grace than ever, with his silver hair. With the impression of dignity and experience, older Christians, can I say, don't you retire. My advice to you is change a letter. Don't retire, refire. Refire. You know, the world puts men off when they're 60, or when they're 55. The assembly is still a place to be graced by older saints with their dignity, with their freshness. Don't become crotchety. It's hard to grow old gracefully. I know some older folks, they're not present here. If they were, I would keep you to 9:30 because I'd want to give them a little word. But some older folks, and they're very wizened, and they're withered, and they're all negative, and they're always complaining, and they're all cranky. And there are no encouragement to a rising generation. There are others can stand back with their dignity. They can allow the young shoots, step back to give the young shoots light and encourage them to grow. I tell you, they are the trees of the Lord planting. And as Mr. Darby translates this verse, fresh and flourishing, he says, they shall be vigorous and green. Green. Not green in the sense of naive, but green in the sense of fresh. I love to see older Christians, and they're green. I think Mr. Darby Levy puts in the expression, full of sap. Full of sap. I know some fellas, and they're full of sauce. And I know some fellas, and they're full of spice. But it's great to be full of sap. How do you keep the sap until you're an old age? You know, Michelangelo, I read today, I better stop here, you'll be looking at Sabbath. I read today about Michelangelo. He did the Sistine Chapel, lying on his back in the scaffolding when he was almost 90. So some of you fellas have a bit to go yet, although I'm not sure there are many Michelangelos just around here. But nonetheless, you don't need Socrates. Socrates published some of his greatest works when he was 80. Cato, the famous Roman, he began to learn Greek when he was 70. You think about Churchill. I was reading, telling the folks about Gladstone the other day. When he retired in his 80s, he had a library of 20,000 books, William Gladstone. Very noble man in many ways. A third of a mile from his home, he got a room that he established as a library full of big iron pillars called the Iron Library. The 20,000 books, his private books, had to be put to this library.
When he was 84, he moved them all himself in a wheelbarrow. 20,000 of them. I tell you, when you're 80, you're not finished. There's still more to be left.
And if a man enjoys the Sabbath in his soul,
I tell you, there's no knowing what vigor it can put into the senior days of his life. Sabbath enjoyment generates praise, grants perspective, guarantees progress. May God grant we the Sabbath saints for his glory and to the blessing of many, shall we pray. Perfect.